of amphetamines. She held it up, shook it as if it were a maraca. "For this?" Rose asked. "You're fucking up your dream life for this?"
"It's not my dream life. I hate it."
"Dancing? But why? Why all of a sudden?" Rose sat at Ruby's feet, put her hand on Ruby's bare calf.
"You haven't even shaved your legs," she said, rubbing her hand up and down the stubble. "This is not you. It's not you at all."
"There's no meaning," Ruby said, and a small kernel of herself was pleased at last to have found a way to say what was wrong.
"This killing, the riots.
Since when are you such a big civil rights activist?"
"I pay attention to what's happening in the world."
Ruby rubbed her forehead. She felt an enormous headache coming on.
"At least the marchers, they have a purpose.
At least they have something they care passionately about."
"I thought you had dance."
Ruby shook her head, winced with the pain the movement brought on.
"It's not dance, not really. It's prancing. And it's not important. There's nothing of value in it."
"You give people pleasure. You take their minds off of their troubles. You show them beauty."
"It's not enough."
"So, what do you want to do? Protest? Throw rocks through plate glass windows? Set shops on fire? Link arms? Carry placards? And have fire hoses trained on you? Tell me, what exactly is it you want? Because the Ruby Wild I know doesn't sit around feeling sorry for herself. She doesn't drug herself. She deals with things."
"There aren't any black showgirls. Have you noticed?"
"None."
"Why not?
Is Vegas only for white people?" "And as for Ruby Wild," she said, flinging her hands in the air as if she were tossing confetti,
"it's not even my name. Come on, really? Have you even noticed?"
Ruby looked into her friend's face.
"Nothing in this entire place is real. It's all fake. It's all smoke and mirrors, painted scenery, silicone tits, dyed hair, fake eyelashes, fake tans. I spent my entire childhood wanting to be anyone but who I was. And man, I sure found that. I don't wear costumes. I wear disguises. I don't even know who I am anymore."
Rose sat listening as Ruby continued at full speed. "You're the only one honest enough to go by her real name, not Vivid, not D for Delicious or Desire or Delight, whatever the hell it is. I'm a fake, faker by the day.
You're real to me. You're the only genuine thing, the only real person in this whole fucking shithole. I mean, what are we doing? The real world is trying to stop a war, to find racial equality. Not us. Not Viva Las Vegas. We're living in La La Land. We're hanging on by our fingernails to the good old days. Dean Martin, Sinatra, Rosemary Clooney, Andy Williams."
Seeing Rose's expression, Ruby stopped with the list making.
"They're the past. I mean, it's ridiculous. Vegas takes the current hits, but only the ones that don't say anything. The ones that won't make people stop and think. That just tell them what they want to hear."
She began humming Marvin Gaye's "Ain't No Mountain High Enough."
"We'll perform those, dance to those, but Monterey or All Along the Watchtower? No, those songs might actually say something, mean something."
She took a breath in preparation for yet another verbal sprint.
"Come on," Rose said, trying to pull Ruby up and out of the chair.
"You're gonna go stand under the shower, and then I'm taking you out for a steak. Thick, red, juicy steak."
"Maybe it's just as well," Ruby said, resisting Rose's tug. "They'd take purple haze and have us shout, 'Kiss the sky,' while wearing headdresses in the shape of giant red lips."
Ruby giggled at the image.
"Stand up. You have to eat."
"I can't eat."
"You're going to, so give up now."
Rose led her down the hallway, and then while Ruby watched, Rose lifted the toilet lid, unscrewed the bottle top, and tilted the jar of pills into the toilet bowl.
"I can get more," Ruby said.
"Anytime, all I want." I know that, but it's a start. Rose tossed the empty bottle in the trash and turned on the shower. She tested the water temperature with her hand. Get those clothes off and get in, she commanded. Much to Ruby's surprise, she did as she was told. Ruby had forgotten just how good a shower could feel, and she lingered beneath the flow of warm water. She inhaled the rose, sandalwood, and flowery scents of her Yardley Cadine perfumed soap and realized that something was trying to escape. Something that lived deep inside her, that had settled in the marrow of her bones. The speed was beckoning this ancient, lurking thing, this boiling black anger and shame, to escape. Clearly, Ruby could not afford this. She'd go crazy. Rose was right. She had to quit the speed. When she climbed out of the shower, Rose handed her a clean towel. At least your bed was made, Rose smiled. I always make my bed. Ruby toweled her hair. I cannot stand an unmade bed. It feels dirty. As if something's terribly, terribly wrong, in a really perverse way. She looked in the mirror, shouted down the pictures of Uncle Miles that had arisen, unbidden. In her steamy reflection, she could see the curve of each rib, the adamant jut of her hip bones. Rose stood behind her, watching Ruby's expression as she discovered just how wasted she'd become. Jesus, kiddo, Rose said. You don't do a single solitary thing by half measure, do you? Ruby looked pleadingly toward her friend's reflected face. I know it's making me crazy, but I'm not thinking right anymore. But I don't know how to stop. I don't know if I can. You can. If anyone can, it's you. I already talked to a doctor, and he told me what you can expect. Rose held up fingers, counted off the side effects of amphetamine withdrawal. Fatigue. You'll probably sleep a whole bunch, then suffer more insomnia for several days, he said. You'll either be hyper or dragged out. Slow on the uptake. You might have nightmares. But, she said, holding up a final finger, you'll be hungry enough to eat a horse. She grinned. Ruby touched her hip bone. A man could slice himself open on this, she thought, before promising Rose she'd try. She would try. 11. Awash in Rose's kindness and humbled by her friend's love, Ruby got clean. It wasn't easy. As a matter of fact, it was far worse than Rose had predicted. For more nights than seemed possible, Ruby was both exhausted and insomniac. She grew increasingly frantic, watching the hours of 2, 3, and 4 a.m. slip past while she remained adamantly awake. In the daylight, her thoughts seemed sluggish, delayed. She would stand in the grocery store, staring into the pyramids of apples and oranges, and she'd wonder what she'd come to buy. She couldn't even manage to choose one variety of apple over another. Intense cravings nearly consumed her willpower, and all the while, she could sense Vivid's cachet of drugs so close by. But Scallywag held on, and once she broke free of the drug, Ruby found it unbelievable that she'd descended as she had. She paged through her frenzied design sketches and saw them for the crazy, drug-fueled failures that they were. She burned them in the apartment complex's barbecue pit, and as the smoke rose, Ruby decided she'd give up cigarettes, too. My body is my temple, she told herself, smiling. You sound like you've found Jesus or something, Vivid said when she came by with a bottle of wine and Ruby turned that down, too. Get real, Vivid said. You can't be a showgirl and refuse to drink. You just can't. That Ruby had to agree with, and so she'd drawn the line at banning booze. Still, as the days passed, she felt stronger, more herself than she had in months. She'd successfully mortared in whatever darkness had tried to overtake her. And she thought she understood something. Dance was enough when it served as the vehicle of her escape from Kansas, her childhood. But now that she'd left Kansas in the dust, dancing wasn't enough. Reading the newspaper, reading books, that wasn't enough either. Was it love? Was Rose right? Did she need a more permanent, reliable man in her life? Maybe the aviator was right. She needed to use her brain, not just her body. But how? She told herself she'd find the answer, search for it. For now, she knew only one thing with certainty. It was time to go back to work. Ruby passed the artist, Constance Maxwell, at her usual spot in the lobby of the Dunes, where she created pastel portraits of patrons. Finding Bob Christensen's office, Ruby laid on his desktop the $100 poker chip he'd given her.
"I don't know if you remember me," she began.
"Honey, everyone worth his salt knows who Ruby Wilde is."
"Well, I'd like to work for you, to dance for you, here in the Casino de Paris show, the Persian Theater, wherever you'll have me."
"You want to wear costumes by the god otherwise known as Carlos Garcia Vargas?"
"I do."
"You want to pose for photos on the race course, at card tournaments, if that's what I ask you to do? Even if the publicity job is set for 10 a.m. and you didn't get to bed until 3 or 4?
"I do."
"You remember I'm a straight shooter. I tell it like I see it."
"I do."
"Well then, Ruby Wilde, to dance for me, you need to put on some weight." He looked straight through her attempt at disguise, a loose-fitting silk tunic top and black palazzo pants. "Men don't fantasize about fucking a coat hanger."
Ruby pressed her lips together. She'd been trying to regain weight. She'd have to try harder.
"Deal?"
he asked. Ruby extended her hand. "Deal."
"Start learning the routines. See Charlotte backstage. Give her this," he said, writing instructions on the back of his business card, just as he'd done when Ruby first met him. "She'll fix you up."
"Thanks."
"Remember when I told you that you had the perfect showgirl body?"
"I do."
"Then get it back. Once you do that, we'll talk again."
"Okay."
"One more thing," he said, standing and stretching his back. "And this is non-negotiable. Stay off the speed."
She hid her surprise. Apparently, Bob Christensen did see everything.
"I will."
Ruby slid her sunglasses back on and left the casino. She felt that if she had said one more "I do," someone would have had to pronounce them man and wife. She towed the line at the dunes. Ruby ate at least 6 meals a day, gobbled mixing bowls full of pudding. She added avocados to nearly everything. She buttered and ate bread and more bread, fully loaded baked potatoes, entire cans of nuts. Slowly, the weight climbed back on, and she started to see soft curves replace forbidding bone. Celebrating the dawn of 1969 with her friends, Ruby made a silent wish for love and inspiration in the new year. The aviator sent her a Christmas card, letting her know that he'd been transferred to Kirtland Air Force Base in Albuquerque. He'd be much closer, and she thought that one day she just might surprise him with a visit. In the meantime, Ruby dutifully replaced her wallet's old emergency notification card with a new one, including the aviator's updated contact information. Ruby thought about the passage of time, the changes she'd seen and made since she'd arrived in Vegas coming up on 2 years ago. Soon she would turn 20, and the undercurrent of dissatisfaction she'd felt while drugged remained. To tolerate the superficialities she'd begun to refer to as Vegas plastic, she came up with a plan for escape. Ruby tallied her savings, which were substantial, given her income of just about $60,000 a year, including all of the gifts she'd converted to cash, the chips she'd been given by enamored men. She had nearly $80,000 in savings. She told herself she would dance for one more year, smile and charm and stomach Vegas life for that single year, and then she'd set herself up as a designer. She was thinking about L.A. And,
If only he would mentor her, she was determined to get Carlos Garcia Vargas's help. He'd been designing at the dunes since 1963 and was known for his use of rich textiles. Vargas didn't limit himself to silks or satins. He used chinchilla, velvet, and fox. One of the first costumes Ruby wore of his design was made entirely of strings of hot pink beads that were held together by gold-toned cuffs located at strategic points, upper arms, hips, neck. Lacing meant to simulate a Roman soldier's footwear ran from ankle to calf, and Ruby's headdress was a complicated tower of black, knotted material that swiveled marvelously when she moved. There was a diamond-shaped cutout revealing her belly button, and rows of diamond cutouts marched dangerously low across her belly. Vargas also created costumes with enormous, feathered back pieces that looked like sails and turned the showgirls into stately, bare-breasted birds that floated across the stage. The back pieces were unwieldy, and their size, as much as 10 feet wide and 8 feet high, made it difficult to maneuver and see the other dancers. Still, once the girls stopped bumping into each other and got the hang of it, the costumes really were impressive, if merely because of their overblown qualities. They were extravagant in Vegas, and that was definitely saying something.
"You can't just show up with some drawings and expect to be hired," Vargas told her. Seated in his studio, he was wearing blue-striped, flared pants with a neon-green silk shirt. A vibrant, purple silk handkerchief bloused from the pocket of his navy blue blazer, and his black Italian boots had decorative straps that crisscrossed at the ankle. He caught Ruby looking at the boots.
"They made me think of Michelangelo's bondage slaves," he grinned.
"I don't..." Ruby shook her head.
"He carved the figures emerging from stone, but not fully. They're still largely encased, and they're chained, ropes across chests, tied down, hint, hint," he said, grinning even more widely.
"Oh."
"That's my point, don't you see?"
He crossed his legs, bounced the top leg as if to bring her attention even more fully to the boots.
"That's exactly why you need formal training. In design school, you'd have classes in art history. You'd learn what's been done. You'd get context."
"That's necessary?" she asked, forcing herself to look away from his jittery leg. For a moment, she wondered if he was on amphetamines, but then she spotted the coffee maker parked unobtrusively on his credenza, next to a spider plant that needed water. She felt her own dry mouth, longed for one of the butter rum lifesavers she still used to keep from smoking.
"Your work is okay," he said,
using a flat tone to signal his ambivalence.
"If you had mountains of talent, you might get away with skipping some kind of coursework. But even then," he leaned toward her for emphasis, "you need a solid foundation in fabrics, in pattern making, draping, drawing, especially from models."
He wore his dark, straight hair long, past his chin, and had pronounced mutton-chop sideburns. A mustache floated above his upper lip, and Ruby thought it looked pasted on. Well, why not? Women had their hairpieces, after all. She looked at the wall behind Vargas, at the drawings he'd mounted there. She couldn't draw nearly as well as that, so cleanly. The sketches were elegant in their austerity. By comparison, her work made her feel like a fourth grader, drawing Huck Finn standing in a stream so that she wouldn't have to try to get his feet right.
"Look, I'll help you some, point you in the right direction. I'm willing to do that, when time permits. But Ruby, girl, you can't just rely on your looks, which is exactly what you did when you came to Vegas, am I right?"
He picked up a pen she thought was a joke. It was fashioned like an antique feather pen, but this pen's feather was a giant ostrich plume dyed banana yellow. Vargas used it to stroke his chin. Feathers and bondage, Ruby thought. Wow.
"I came to dance," she said, And yes, my looks got me hired.
But they won't do a thing when it comes to fashion design. Your portfolio will get you hired. And to develop a portfolio, you need the background. Don't skip the necessary steps. You'll just regret it. Even then, what you'll get is an apprenticeship. This profession is far more involved than showing up with a few drawings.
He pushed her portfolio across his desk toward her.
Comprende?
Vargas let her have his design drawing for the hot pink beaded costume, and he even autographed it. She saw that he drew in black ink and used watercolors. She'd been using colored pencils, and she could see how much richer the paint made his work. Even that little thing she'd done wrong. Maybe he had a point. Ruby took stock. She thought about the past several months, what she'd been doing with herself, how she could use her leisure time to pursue her dreams. Ruby began to scrutinize Vargas's designs more closely. She tried to discern his inspirations, his historical references. She devoured fashion magazines, tore pages out of Vogue, and put them into a notebook. She dissected trends. Jane Fonda's Barbarella had latched on to the space craze and took everyone by storm. Her tousled, just-got-out-of-bed curls, the boots that came up to her thighs, her cleavage. Fonda's rampant sexuality, her ability to project both vulnerability and availability, put Ruby's own efforts to shame. Ruby added Fonda to her notebook. She became a sponge, soaking up everything from everywhere, observing, learning, assimilating, and practicing. She was thinking about design schools, where she'd go, when she'd start applying. She also made an even more committed effort to stay tuned in to the real world. So many changes, such upheaval had characterized the past year. Nina Simone was singing the desperation of the times in response to King's assassination, asking, "What's going to happen now that the King of Love is dead?" Sirhan Sirhan had gunned down Bobby Kennedy just 2 months after the King assassination, and Ruby remembered how overwrought she'd been when King was killed, how out of control. She felt such sadness over the hope that had been Kennedy, but at least when that killing happened, she hadn't found herself driving around Vegas in a drug-induced state of hysterical mania. Still, it was incomprehensible, the country's growing propensity for endless bloodletting, the winnowing of leaders with vision and optimism. Buddhist monks set themselves on fire in Vietnam, and in the August heat, the Democratic National Convention had erupted into unfathomable violence. Ruby had watched the footage of Chicago cops with clubs beating anti-war protesters until they bled. Those kids were her age. They were out there doing something, while she did nothing. For the first time, she realized that Vietnam cast no shadows beneath the lights of Vegas. There were no flag-shrouded caskets, no hollowed, haunted eyes of returning soldiers anywhere near the casinos. How efficiently Las Vegas seemed to be able to keep hippies away from the Strip, where they might hurt business. The rest of the city was normal: trailer parks, grocery stores, shoe stores, schools, doctor's offices, and churches. But tourists didn't see those neighborhoods, and certainly Ruby had never been invited into any of those suburban living rooms. She'd been living in La La Land for far too long.
Slut! Bitch!
Up to that point, it had been a good evening. Ruby and Chicago Johnny were leaving Circus Maximus at Caesars, where they'd sampled Chef Laszlo Dorogi's famous sugar sculptures and sat back while Eartha Kitt purred her way through a performance. In one number, Kitt had worn a tight, silver swirl of a cocktail dress, cut low, virtually strapless. And at last, Ruby understood what Vargas meant about learning to drape. The dress had such superb folds. They followed the curves of Kit's body as she sang C'est si bon.
Cunt!
This time, the woman's shriek caught Ruby's attention.
Yeah, you, bitch!
Before Ruby could put up a defensive hand,
The woman swung her purse at Ruby's face and struck her across her nose and left eye. There was an audible crunch, and then the woman hit Ruby again, this time harder, before Johnny managed to grab a hold of the purse. The woman didn't let go of the strap, and Johnny held on too. Ruby put a hand to her face, saw blood, and felt her eyes watering. Her nasal passages stung sharply, and it felt as if her nose had been shoved a good 2 inches into her skull. Still holding the crazed woman's arm, Johnny passed Ruby his handkerchief. She pressed as hard as the pain would permit and tried to stop the bleeding.
"She fucks other women's husbands,"
the woman yelled, still in full battle mode.
"Everyone, everyone, right here," she yelled
and pointed with her free hand.
"This cunt here won't cost you much, but you'll have to get in line."
Ruby overheard a man on the sidewalk say, "Who wouldn't want to sink his torpedo in that redhead?" "Ma'am," Johnny said, using a calm tone to try to control the woman. "Please."
"Who are you? The whore's daddy? Maybe you're her pimp,"
the woman sneered.
"Give me back my purse, thief, thief!"
Ruby's vision had cleared some, but the woman, a middle-aged blonde with dark roots, a thick waist of undulating hills, and red lipstick run amok, wasn't the least bit familiar. God knows who her husband was, or if the woman even had the right showgirl. Johnny twisted the strap on the woman's handbag until it dug into her forearm.
"Ow!" she yelled. "Quit it!"
"Cease and desist," he said, making Ruby want to laugh.
Johnny sounded as if he'd been watching reruns of Dragnet.
"Let go of me!"
"I'll let go when you simmer down."
He kept the purse strap twisted so tightly that Ruby could see the woman's skin folding. She couldn't help but think that it was yet another example of Vargas's draping lecture. And that's when Ruby started giggling. This whole night, what a night. Soon enough, she was laughing so hard that it was difficult to catch her breath. She was standing there, in the parking lot in front of Caesar's, a bloody handkerchief held to her nose, blood no doubt sprayed across the front of her strapless white beaded gown. Some loony woman was accusing her of taking her husband, and an aging mobster was holding the woman hostage via her purse strap. Jesus!
"You think this is funny?" the woman spat at Ruby. "You think husband stealing is a laughing matter?"
"I don't want your husband, whoever he is," Ruby said. Her voice sounded stuffy, her nasal passages were full of blood, and she felt more blood sliding down the back of her throat. She also had a massive headache.
"Let her go, Johnny," Ruby sighed. "Let's just get out of here."
He gave the purse one last tug as if to make his point, and then he let the woman go.
"I think you broke her nose," he told the woman.
"Serves her right. That whore broke my heart,"
the woman said, beginning to weep.
"Took my Harry,"
she sobbed. Harry? Ruby wondered. She didn't remember any Harry.
"Go home now," Johnny said, using a firm tone.
"What's left of it after that hussy homewrecker?"
the woman said, turning her back to them. She was wearing a dress made of some sort of sparkly polyester, and there was a huge run up the back of one leg of her pantyhose. The crowd began to disperse. Several of the women looked back at Ruby with disgust.
"So much for innocent until proven guilty," Ruby said, taking Johnny's arm.
"I'll get you to the doctor," he said, looking worriedly into her face. They stopped by a fountain, and he used the multicolored lights to inspect her injuries.
"You're going to have a pair of black eyes, and,"
he gingerly touched the bridge of her nose, which crackled,
"a broken nose."
"Lord," Ruby said, and then she started laughing again.
"You're in shock,"
Johnny said, using his most paternal voice.
"No,"
Ruby said, trying to catch her breath. The bleeding had yet to stop, and she refolded the handkerchief and pressed it back in place.
"This is all just so unreal."
"Ruby,"
It was Rose, jogging out the front doors of Caesar's, carrying a towel filled with ice.
Here, she said, catching up to the two of them, taking the soiled handkerchief from Ruby and gently putting the ice in place. Hold it like that, she said, looking at Johnny as if he were the culprit.
Rose, Johnny, Rose, Ruby said from behind the towel. How did you know? She asked.
One of the bellboys told me. Jesus, Ruby!
I'm taking her to the hospital, Johnny said, sounding as if he were afraid Rose would steal Ruby and deprive him of his hard-won Sir Galahad role.
There's a doctor inside she can see, Rose told him. There's no need to drive her all over town.
Now you two, don't fight over little old me, Ruby said, watching the two of them face off. Rose in her tiny Caesar's toga, Johnny in his 50s mobster getup.
They got on either side of Ruby and marched her back into Caesar's, past the half-dozen people who were still milling about, watching the drama peter out. Johnny, ever the courtly gentleman, held the door for the two women, and Ruby lifted the ice from her face long enough to turn to Rose and say,
I think she had a lead brick in that purse. Or,
she paused, grinning,
maybe she managed to swipe a roulette wheel.
Ruby's face was in the final stages of healing when she met Tom Jones at a party in the Flamingo, where he was performing and getting ready to record his album live in Las Vegas. He was still wearing one of his stage outfits, a white shirt cut nearly to his belly button to reveal a giant gold cross nestled in a frenzy of black chest hair. His shirt had French cuffs with jet black cufflinks and was topped with a black sequined jacket. On his fingers, he wore large shouts of gold jewelry, a pinky ring on one hand, and on the middle finger of his other hand, a ring that looked as though it could knock out Muhammad Ali. Jones had clearly spent a good deal of time in a tanning bed, and Ruby couldn't help but wonder if he had done so in the nude. It was no act. The man exuded raw animal sex. She could feel his energy from across the room, and as she watched him, she smiled and imagined gliding over to ask, "What's new, pussycat?" Vivid introduced them, and Ruby found her eyes straying down to Jones's large, silver and gold oval of a belt buckle, his narrow hips.
Earth to Ruby, Vivid said, teasing.
Hello, sweetheart, Jones said, wrapping Ruby in his arms.
He was damp with sweat from his performance, but it didn't bother her. It was the first time in a long while that Ruby had been starstruck.
Show her, Vivid commanded, smiling slyly.
Slowly, as if performing a salacious magic trick, Jones reached into his pocket and pulled out a pair of pale yellow panties.
I've heard, Ruby said. I gather that at times you're literally pelted with panties.
Yeah, but look closely, Vivid said, taking the panties from Jones and stretching them wide in front of Ruby's face. In black marker, a woman had written her phone number.
And they throw him their hotel room keys, too.
Ha! Ruby laughed. She looked at Vivid. How come that never happens to us?
Boxers or briefs, Vivid grinned. The image of white jockey shorts with illegible scrawls of men's phone numbers was truly funny.
I'd write my number out for you, honey, Jones said, looking intently at Ruby.
They were just about the same height, and although he wore stacked heels, Ruby's heels were taller, so he looked up slightly to meet her eyes.
Tom Jones, you're an incorrigible flirt, Ruby responded. I know you're married.
The whole world knows he's married, Vivid said. Come perform with me, Jones said to Ruby. Even once.
Just be on the stage with me.
Singing? The others will cover for you. Just mouth it.
An ornamental performance?
Why not?
Ruby looked toward Vivid. This must have been why she'd brought her here tonight.
True confession, Jones said. I saw you on stage,
and Vivid and I are old friends.
He put an arm around Vivid, pulled her close, and winked.
Duh, Ruby thought, realizing they must have slept together.
I asked Viv to introduce us, for purely professional reasons, he added.
It'd have to be on one of my nights off. Is that worth it to you? To have costumes fitted for me for just a performance or two?
He writes his own ticket, Vivid assured Ruby. He can do what he wants.
All right, then, Ruby grinned. It sounds like a kick in the ass.
And it was a kick in the ass, just the kind of jolt she needed. Ruby loved being on stage with Jones, the four backup singers lined up alongside her, and the enormous lit TJ hovering above them all like a constellation. The singers were surprisingly gracious, given Ruby's relative lack of vocal talent. She guessed their loyalty to Jones reigned supreme, and she was right. He was known to be a decent, thoughtful employer, someone who understood what it was to come up from nothing by dint of hard, concentrated work. The women were eager to learn a few dance steps from Ruby, and together they concocted some minimal dance routines to add to the show. Jones was a tremendous performer. He genuinely enjoyed what he was doing. And in turn, the audience responded enthusiastically. Sometimes he'd pull Ruby out front with him and force the band to ad-lib while they danced together. Every pelvic thrust, every he uttered made Ruby grin. She was having fun again, and it was marvelous. Things snowballed from there. Through Jones, she met Charo, who was starring with Javier Gugat in Nero's Nook in Caesars. She met Mama Cass and Flip Wilson. Best of all, she met Sammy Davis Jr., who told her he was planning a trip to entertain the troops in Vietnam. He asked if she'd join him, assuming he could pull it all together. Ruby screamed, "Yes!" and in her enthusiasm almost tried to lift the elfin man off of the stage. "Cool, man," was all he said. "I'll be in touch." His proposal was perfection. At long last, she'd be able to do something in the real world. Ruby was well aware of the fact that no one wanted her for who she was, for what she read or thought. Other than the aviator, they didn't care about her opinions or hopes and aspirations. They didn't care if she dreamed of becoming a fashion designer, or if, like Vivid, she dreamed of living in a glass-walled house looking down on the beach at Malibu. Not Tom Jones, not Sammy Davis, not Bob Christensen, or even Daddy Evan Brashear, who asked her to think about returning to the Stardust. They wanted her looks, and to a lesser extent, her talent as a dancer. To them, she was just like Vegas, all glitz and glamour. An anonymous blur, like a passing freight train.
"You're on fire," Rose said. "Really, kiddo, you're lit again. It's the best thing I've seen in ages."
"Except that," Ruby said, pointing to Rose's fourth finger. Rose and Matt, the card dealer, were engaged, with no firm date yet set. Ruby refused to think about it, what it would mean if she lost Rose in her life, if the couple moved elsewhere, which was a distinct possibility.
"Yeah, well," Rose said, blushing. "But as for me, I'll never fall in love again," Ruby sang, a la Mr. Jones.
"I double dog dare you,"
Rose said and punched Ruby lightly in the upper arm.
"As a matter of fact, I triple dog dare you."
Ruby didn't foreclose the possibility of love. She'd never admit it, even to Rose or Vivid. But she fostered a secret, quiet hope that she might find someone, or that someone might find her.
12. They landed on the moon, and the world stopped to watch, even Vegas. Ruby pictured Kyle at home with his family, viewing the same live television coverage. Was he envious? Was he glad for his friends? Was he still writing his stories? She sent him her fondness and hoped that somehow he sensed her. In September of 1969, Torrential rains pounded Las Vegas, and the weak desert sand could not hold the sudden abundance. Caesars flooded, leaving miles of saturated carpet a ready and willing breeding ground for mold. What had been carefully controlled landscaping flowed down the street in putrid gray gobs of dead and dying vegetation. Everyone made the easy connection to Noah, to God's need to wash the world clean. Next, maybe frogs would fall from the sky, or clouds of locusts would scream overhead. After a few days, the floodwaters dried up, and all that was left was the lingering sensation of a wrathful but incomplete apocalypse. The year ended with arrests in the Manson murder spree, fatal stabbings at the Rolling Stones concert at Altamont, underground nuclear detonations at the Nevada test site, just 60-some miles from Vegas, and John and Yoko sponsoring huge billboards that told the world, "War is over if you want it." In November of what was Nixon's first year in office, 700,000 anti-war demonstrators took over the nation's capital. Nearly oblivious, Vegas played on. Dean Martin's opening night at the Sands Copa Room was a mob scene. At the New International Hotel, Elvis performed to sold-out audiences for $125,000 a week, while in Mississippi, the median household income was just over $5,000 a year. Ruby thought the center could not hold. How could it? After less than 3 years in Vegas, she was herself earning far beyond anything Uncle Miles ever could have dreamed of depositing in his Salina bank account. Still not knowing what else she could do, and admittedly not giving the issue any genuinely concerted effort other than a wistful New Year's wish for 1970, she kept her head down, worked, and waited for the Fates, or Sammy Davis, to let her know when her life would hold some wider, less self-serving meaning. Maybe Ruby was primed for love when she spotted the Spanish photographer standing at the foot of the stage apron that January night, when he refused to release her from his gaze. Perhaps Javier Borrero had been foretold all along, in the fine lines of her palm. He didn't stare at Ruby in the lurid, covetous way of most men. He was immediately, obviously different. As she danced in the thrall of his powerful gaze, Ruby was flustered, had to watch her step and be conscious of her balance. She felt her headdress shift when she turned, and she had to resist the temptation to reach up and touch the sequined cap to be sure it stayed on her head. Each time she pivoted toward the audience, she saw him still transfixed by her, and only her. A light meter was looped around his neck, but he held his camera forgotten at his side. Ruby had heard that the watchful Spaniard was the Dune's new professional photographer, yet Javier Borrero hadn't once raised the viewfinder to his eye or clicked the shutter. Instead, he seemed mesmerized by the lengths of pearls softly lapping at her thighs. A tendril of pink ostrich feather tickled Ruby's lower lip and then drifted to the corner of her eye. She swallowed a reflexive sneeze. The feather caught in her false eyelashes, and she blinked rapidly to try to free them. With elegant precision, Ruby descended the calf-killing stage stairs, the other showgirls trailing in her wake like geese in flight. She turned in time with the music, revealed her G-string-clad ass to the man. She faced him again, performed several high kicks, her bare breasts bouncing. Now, she thought, now is when a pasty will pop off, and his only reaction will be to stare impassively. The rhinestones of the showgirls' costumes pulsed beneath rainbow-colored stage lights. There was a crash of cymbals, and the dancers joined to form the pony line, beginning the grand finale of synchronized can-can kicks. The audience broke into enthusiastic applause, but still the photographer remained inert. At last, standing breathless with the other girls and taking a bow, Ruby stole a look at him and felt a trickle of nervous sweat meander down her back. Ruby exited the stage and made her way to her dressing room, knowing that the insistent pull she felt for the Spaniard was chemical, uncontrollable. But it was more than lust. She was connected to this man, maybe from some distant past life, or maybe because they were one and the same. Who knew? And did it matter? She'd seen dozens of gorgeous men trail in and out of the casinos. Elvis, Warren Beatty, Harry Belafonte, even Richard Burton. A man made exponentially more compelling because Elizabeth Taylor walked on his arm. But Javier was the most beautiful man she'd ever seen. He had thick, dark brown hair that fell in waves until its curly tips brushed the collar of his white Nehru jacket. His eyes were chestnut brown beneath heavy, dark brows, and his lips were generous, the dip in his upper lip pronounced. He had a substantial, dignified nose, skin the color of coffee, generously dosed with cream. And the only movement he showed was to purse his lips and knit his brows, as if in thought, each time he took a pull from his cigarette and exhaled a stream of smoke toward the ceiling. Not 1 ounce of Javier Borrero pleaded for Ruby's attention, and she adored that. As she sat before her vanity mirror, and her dresser carefully lifted off the heavy headdress, Ruby felt truly exposed, exquisitely vulnerable. The rule was that whenever a showgirl loused up a number, the whole pony line had to show up the next morning at the ungodly hour of 11 a.m. to rehearse. It was like elementary school. One student screws up, and the entire class has to stay after school. No one was happy about it, but they all knew better than to punish the girl who'd flubbed her steps. Eventually, it happened to all of them. Javier Borrero was there at the rehearsal the next morning, this time actually using his camera. The girls were in full costume, and it was a good opportunity for him to get action publicity shots without distracting an audience. Today he wore casual clothes, bell-bottom jeans, a white poet's shirt, and a wide, brown leather belt cinched with a brass belt buckle that had a Renaissance flourish. His brown-skinned feet were clad in worn leather sandals. His hair was just the right amount of unkempt, and he wore a black scarf tied loosely about his neck. The dance routine was punishing not for the steps, but for the props. The curtains opened to the girls hanging from the ceiling, each in her own see-through lucite bathtub filled with clear plastic ping-pong balls meant to simulate a bubble bath. The number was set to a jazzed-up version of Bobby Darin's Splish Splash. The costumes, tight, aqua-toned split skirts and armbands with fish fins made of ribbed gold, blue, and green satins, were great in theory. The problem came when the girls were to climb from the bathtubs out onto tiny individual platforms that hovered a good 5 to 7 feet above the stage floor. The mermaid tail skirts limited movement, and inevitably, several of the ping-pong balls would escape the sides of the tubs as the dancers maneuvered onto the platforms. High heels and small balls flying like erratic popcorn, it was a decidedly bad combination, and nearly all of the girls had fallen at some point. Despite all of this, the choreographer was unwilling to reconsider the number, and there was half-hearted talk amongst the showgirls that the insurance company should be notified. The danger was apparent, and it seemed inevitable that someone was going to get hurt. The Spaniard moved below them, shooting upward. Ruby watched him move in closer until she could see the top of his head, his hands holding his camera as if it were holy, an offering bowl held before an altar. Ruby noticed that there was something off about his right foot. Where toes should have extended from his sandal, there was only a single big toe. It couldn't be that they were folded under. No, Ruby thought, they're gone. His limp was barely discernible, She was both curious as to what might have happened to him and surprised that he wore sandals, that he made no effort to disguise his disfigurement. She felt a sense of instant kinship with the Spaniard, the unshakable certainty that their flaws sang in harmony. Ruby longed to examine the details of his palms. She wanted to measure his lifeline, discover his childhood. She wanted to count his lovers, the horizontal lines secreted on the side of his hand beneath his pinky finger, and to see if maybe she could find herself there. That was when Ruby slipped. The toe of her shoe slid over the edge of her tiny platform, and her ankle fought futilely for balance on the half-inch surface of her stiletto heel. Ruby fell 6 feet, directly into the arms of Javier Barrero. There was a shriek of pain in her ankle, a chaos of ping-pong balls in her peripheral vision, but all she knew was the musk of him, the deep woods scent, as if he'd been sleeping in a soft, yielding bed of decaying oak leaves. Together, they tumbled to the ground. Javier's body cushioned her fall, and she immediately worried that she'd crushed his camera. He was splayed out on the stage beneath her, and she was struggling to right herself, to keep her heels from gouging him. Finally, the band stopped, and a couple of dancers rushed to help her. Each grabbed an arm, and when Ruby stood, she felt her ankle's unwillingness to hold her. The girls half-dragged her to the lowest stage step, and Ruby unbuckled her shoe and gingerly began rubbing her ankle, all the while watching the Spaniard as he slowly gathered his wits and stood. "Your camera," she said when he looked her direction. "He's all right," he said, neither smiling nor frowning. "I cover it with my hands, like this," he demonstrated, clutching the camera to his abdomen, a running back tucking the football into his gut. Ruby couldn't read him, couldn't tell if he was angry.
"We told you this would happen,"
one of the girls yelled at the choreographer, who'd at last deigned to approach and check on Ruby.
"No more," another girl said. "We won't do this number. Are you waiting for someone to break her neck?"
The others were nodding in agreement. They stepped down from their various perches and gathered about Ruby on the stairway, an impromptu sit-in.
"But your contracts require,"
the choreographer said rather feebly. Barrero knelt and gently took Ruby's foot into his hands.
"Relax your foot, your ankle," he instructed, and then waited until she complied.
He compressed her foot at the base of her toes with one hand while cupping her heel in the other.
"Is painful?"
She shook her head. He moved his hand up toward her ankle, increasing the pressure only as her facial expression permitted. He circled her ankle with his thumb.
"That's sore,"
she said, thinking the injury was well worth it, just to have his warm hands caressing her foot.
"Flexiona, you must flex the foot."
She felt the muscles of her arch tight and sharp, and she flinched.
"I think I pulled the muscles, mostly," she said. "They're tender."
At her use of tender, he took his eyes completely away from her foot. Instead, looked into her face. And he smiled, his first smile, the first emotion she'd seen cross his face. Carefully, he set down her foot and picked up her discarded shoe, holding it as if it were some rare captive bird.
"Los zapatos de tacón. Of course you have hurted your arch," he said, and in his accent she thought she could feel the noon heat in Barcelona, that she could smell oranges ripening in a silver, sun-struck bowl. This close to him, with all the others disappearing like inconsequential dandelion fluff, she could see two tiny moles punctuating the outer corner of his left eye. A third strayed onto his cheekbone and rested there. A challenge. 13.
Ruby was spending a quiet night at home, nursing her wounds and reading a paperback when the doorbell rang. Javier Barrero stood in the glow of her porch light, a bouquet of pink roses in one hand, a can of Campbell's chicken noodle soup in the other.
I skinned my butt, Ruby laughed. Isn't chicken soup for a sore throat?
If you letted me in, I explain, he smiled.
All right. She combed her hair with her fingers and thought maybe she should change out of her short black silk robe. Javier eyed her legs as he set the flowers and soup on the kitchen bar. There's a vase in the cabinet beneath the sink, Ruby said, opting to pull on a denim miniskirt and t-shirt. I'll be right back. Oh, and there's beer in the refrigerator. Once dressed, she took an extra few seconds to look at herself in the bathroom mirror. She was makeup-free, but, well. He'd come unannounced. Surely he couldn't expect her to look her best. Thank you, she said, returning to the living room and accepting a bottle of beer. For the flowers, too. He'd set them on the side table between her wing-back chairs. They're lovely. Javier tapped the neck of his bottle against hers.
I am hoping for you to get better soon.
Limping slightly, an ace bandage wrapped around her ankle, she led him to the couch. So, she said, the soup. She knew he watched her throat move as she closed her eyes, tilted her head back, and took a sip of beer.
The word in Spanish for throat,
he moved his hand along his own throat,
is cuello. I had this American friend learning Spanish. He told me he was not there for rugby practice the day before because he had an infection in his culo.
Javier began to laugh.
You see? He's very close, but he's wrong. He wanted to tell me he had an infection in his cuello, his throat, but he said culo, and dad means he had an infection in his asshole. I said to him that he should no be telling me all this. It was just too intimate, he winked at her.
Okay, that's funny, Ruby grinned.
I was only glad that he said that to me, not to someone important.
Javier ran his palm up and down his thigh as if he were wiping his palm clean.
So the chicken soup is for my sore culo? Ruby asked, smiling.
Yes, that was my joke.
Very good, she said, again touching the neck of her bottle to his. I like a man with a sense of humor.
I like you, he said, and I have come here tonight because I don't play the mouse and cat game.
He shrugged his shoulders, looked down, and smiled shyly. I'm glad you're here, she said. He was wearing a white cotton shirt with the sleeves rolled up to his elbows, a look that on him was elegant. I just wish I looked better. He looked up, genuinely surprised by what she'd said.
Oh, no, he shook his head. You are so much more beautiful without that, como se dice,
he rubbed his forehead.
Maquillaje.
Makeup?
Yes, that's it. For the stage is one thing. For the rest of your life, I say no. I say you must be your real self, your true self.
He had a muscular neck and heavily muscled shoulders, maybe from the rugby he'd mentioned, and already he'd zeroed in on what she'd been thinking about forever. What was real? What wasn't? Plastic, manufactured fantasy versus genuineness, truthfulness. He didn't want to play any mouse and cat game. He wasn't some slick gambler feeding her a line. He was a man, struggling in a second language to tell her what he honestly thought and felt. Javier, she said, setting her beer bottle on a coaster. Will you take me out on a date?
I had that planned.
He smiled widely, his eyes gold in the light of her lamp table.
Do you know Dinah Shore? She's at the Sands in the Celebrity Theater, is called.
Dinah Shore? Who was this man? How did he know the child she'd been? Lily, planted in front of Aunt Tate's